You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. I am Edward Song. I am an associate professor at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And I am with my co-host, Coyle Neal, who is an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Guten Abend, Herr Professor Neal.
How's it going, Ed? Sorry, the foreign language threw me for a second.
Yeah, sorry. Did you do German?
I didn't. I did Latin and French, and Lord willing, we'll never have to do another language ever.
Yeah, I would. I did German. I did Latin in high school. I did German in college. I did Spanish as well. I'm going to recover my Spanish. Do you ever mess around? Well, I guess given what you just said, I know the answer to this question. But you don't mess around with like one of those language apps, do you?
No. Not only do I not really care for languages, I don't have a smartphone. So, kind of a double whammy. Yeah.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised that a paleo-conservative such as yourself would be denying the newfangled technologies.
I mean, it's not even general opposition to technology. It's expensive. So
you're on a good old-fashioned flip phone.
I am literally on a family plan, old-fashioned flip phone.
Wow, man.
So our cell phone bill is, like, together as a family is maybe what most people would pay for a smartphone bill. And I'm very, very comfortable with that.
Yeah, I actually don't think of our phone bill as being particularly expensive, but I don't know. Anyways, as my wife is super interested in digital technology and is a critic of it, she at least would be heartened that people are still using the old fangled flip phones.
Yeah, so someday Verizon is going to tell us we can't use them anymore, and then we'll have to go back to the landline.
So. Wow. I mean, but you can get not the most newfangled iPhone, but you can get a smartphone. I mean, you can get smartphones. They basically give them away.
Yeah, sure. But then the plan is expensive.
Yeah, but then you don't even really need a data plan. Like, I actually, well, I mean, this is, people didn't tune into this for a smartphone plan information, but like, sure, we got a plan for my daughter that I think literally costs $12 a month.
Oh, sure. And you don't need one at all if you're going to use it as a tablet. So we have an iPhone something or other from 10 years ago that we basically, like, the wife uses it to listen to podcasts off of our household wireless.
Yeah.
But again, that's, even that, it's a convenience. It's not really necessary. Like, if it cost us anything, we probably wouldn't use it. Mm-hmm. So, like, if there were a regular charge attached, like, it does what our computers do. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there you are. Yeah. There is our life advice.
A deeply conflicted life advice, right? Which is not inappropriate for what we're talking about today.
It's true. Before we get to what we're talking about today, I should mention, we checked our email the other day. You know, we had a show where we talked about our youngest listener, and I think we set the over-under at 27, and you took the over. You didn't think that there were any listeners under the age of 27. I think I took the under.
I thought I took the under.
No, well, really?
I don't remember now. It's been weeks.
Anyways, I'm happy to report that our there might be listeners younger than this, but our youngest confirmed listener is Mr. Benjamin Ashby, who is at the spry age of 21. So congratulations, Benjamin Ashby. Do you remember being 21, Coyle?
I do.
I don't remember being 21.
I'm not terribly impressed with myself at 21, but I do remember it.
I should also add that I was very pleased to see an email from Stephen Crawford, who is currently an Episcopal priest in South Louisiana and a former student of mine at LSU. Glad that Stephen is listening. He asked an awesome question to which I responded. We promised some kind of award to our youngest listener, didn't we? I can't remember what it was. Like you were going to record a voicemail message or something like that.
Yeah, man. Again, I will have to go back and listen to that. I clearly did poor show prep today.
Benjamin, please reach out and Coyle will be in communication about how to receive. Right, that's you get that joke, right? That's a I'm not even sure that I entirely get the joke, but it's the NPR show. Was it in Morning Edition? No, wait, what is it? There's an NPR show where Carl Castle. It's in Weekend Edition, right, where they do the puzzles.
You lost me at NPR show, Ed. Unless you're talking talk radio from like 20 years ago, I couldn't tell you.
There's the NPR show where they do there's like a game, and if you win the game, then Carl Castle will come on and record your voicemail message or something like that. I confess that I myself don't listen to NPR much these days, just because I find it all too depressing. But in any case, that was what the joke was supposed to be about. We should probably get to the show, but I can't help but ask you your thoughts on impeachment. Coyle and I are recording this episode in the middle of October. We did an impeachment episode back in August, which seems like such a long time ago, those innocent days in early August. Do you remember that, when the president wasn't literally incriminating himself on the White House lawn? But do you have any current thoughts on impeachment?
I mean, so obviously the big thing that has changed is now the Speaker of the House has announced an impeachment inquiry, whatever that means. I think as is often the case, we're in an age where both hypocrisy and being mildly delusional sort of shapes our politics. So if you're a Trump supporter and you think that Trump has genuinely done nothing at least worth looking at, I think there's some self-deception going on there. On the other hand, if you're a Trump opponent and are supportive of this and think that this is not on some level an attempt to swing the 2020 election, I think there's also some self-deception going on there. I don't think there's anything that's happened that now this is the straw that broke the camel's back, other than the timing for 2020. Now, I don't know specifically what the calculus is there, but I mean, this is also, I think, pretty obviously a political maneuver as much as it is anything genuinely idealistic.
So I'm going to disagree with you very strongly, not to the extent to which, I mean, it's obviously a political maneuver, if only because it's impossible to separate out political calculuses from decisions like this under any circumstances, and especially in the year before an election.
Right. So I'm saying it's the dominant factor. It might not be the only one. There might be some legitimate,
I very strongly disagree with that. The big thing that has happened is that it's been revealed that Trump has had these conversations with the president of Ukraine. We didn't know anything about that. Well, maybe some people knew things about that, but we didn't really know anything about that in August. And now he has become so defiant in flouting traditional norms of democratic governance that it just becomes impossible. And it's really clear that, I mean, again, you can't eliminate political calculations in all of this, but Nancy Pelosi does not want to run impeachment hearings. It's not clear that running impeachment hearings is good politically at all for the Democrats.
Well, I don't know that she will. I don't know that she will run impeachment hearings, but
it may be a good time
to distract the president and to take focus off of the zoo that is the Democratic primary debates. And
because there were certainly elements in the Democratic Party that were stumping for impeachment hearings and a vote very, very strongly, and she was very vociferously resisting them. She did not want to do it. That was clear to everybody. And I think she didn't want to do it because she thinks that's politically bad for Democrats. And I agree with her on that, actually. She was forced into it. just because the flouting got so extreme. He was literally on the White House lawn calling for the Russians to investigate, to help investigate Joe Biden. Like, you can't do
this,
that.
This is the thing that for you has done it, right? Not when he did that for Hillary, like, this is the one.
Yeah, so it really is the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, we've talked about all of this. You know what I think about that. I mean, I think all of that was impeachable. Though I would say that as a practical matter, like, I had, we've talked about this all before, I think he's 100% impeachable. I myself had little appetite for that. I mean, you know, I mean, impeachment is a really extreme thing. I mean, it's one thing for a person to have done things that are deserving of an impeachment hearing or an impeachment vote or an impeachment trial. But that is an extreme measure, you know? I mean, that is like radical surgery for a dying patient, you know? And I had little appetite for that just because it's such an extreme procedure, in part because we're so close to an election and it would be much better just to deal with this in terms of an election and voting him out of office. And because for the selfish, self-interested reason that I think it's bad for Democrats politically. Like, I really believe
that. I don't know. I mean, if you time this right, and assuming it actually goes anywhere, which again, until they actually hold the vote, I'm going to be skeptical as to whether or not anything will come of this. But were this to be somewhat successful, again, if I'm a Democratic strategist and advising the various powers that be, you time it in such a way that Trump is either out or kept from campaigning, and a Pence campaign never really has an opportunity to get off the ground. It's not because he's done anything so differently egregious now as compared to anything over the last 3 years. It's just this is a good time for it politically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are Democratic strategists who are making that argument. But to me, it just becomes such a potent tool. It's certainly not going to hurt his base. I mean, he could literally do what he said he could do in about shooting people in broad daylight in New York City, and his most diehard supporters would stay with him, and it's going to help immensely with the get out the vote and their get out the vote effort. And while it's true that I'm sure there are Democratic strategists who are making that argument, Nancy Pelosi clearly doesn't think it's good for them, and I agree with her.
Well, and literally, no one's, you're right, literally no one's opinion is going to change about him through this. The people who don't like him don't like him, and the people who do like him do like him. And impeachment, even if it succeeds, isn't going to change that. Which, again, I'm skeptical as to whether it'll go through the House. And if it does go through the House, it's not going to go through the Senate. So,
for sure. Though there was the quote from the former Republican senator who was like, if it was an anonymous ballot, 30 Republicans would vote for impeachment.
Sure.
I don't doubt that at all. I don't know what you think of that.
I'm sure there are that many Republicans that don't like him. But again, I think it would depend on the timing. Like, if it were happened tomorrow and were to be an anonymous ballot, maybe. But again, you hit that tipping point where now it is affecting their chances of winning the 2020 election. Right.
I really don't think so. I mean, I think if they vote, if they actually have a trial, I think the odds of him getting impeached are virtually nil. And I think it helps in their get out the vote efforts. If they actually succeed, I actually still think it helps them because, I mean, I didn't exactly know how the logistics of this, but I think Pence would be a much better candidate than Trump.
If he has time to run a campaign.
If he has time to run a campaign. But in any case, But to me, the tipping point, so like I have little appetite for this, but the tipping point is exactly the fact that it's such a in-your-face, shameless flouting of Democratic norms that you have to draw the line.
Yeah, and it's been that for 3 years. Like this is why I am skeptical of. I don't deny that that's the case for you personally, but when the Democrats politically say that nah, this is their moment. They see that this is the time to do it, not because they actually think he is worse today than he was a year ago.
There's no evidence to think that. We know Pelosi,
other than they're actually now
it.
Doing the impeachment. There is literal evidence for that.
What's happened since then? The Ukraine thing.
Yeah, and again, my point is that's not actually worse than anything he's done prior to this.
So,
in fact, it's literally the same as his asking for China to investigate Hillary.
No. You know, so the difference is this. In the past, he denied having the conversations. Now, he's like, yeah, we had the conversations, and there's nothing wrong with them. That's the difference. That's a material difference.
Having read the transcript they released... Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what I would vote on that sort of thing. Because I suspect what happens is, again, people who like him read it and they're like, yeah, this is fine. People who don't like him read it and are like, yeah, this is clearly impeachable.
Well, look, but that's... you're like a sophist when you say that. I mean, that's true, but then we could have an inquiry, we could have a debate about whether those offenses are impeachable. Whether they're high crimes and misdemeanors.
Or whether it's even an offense, right? I mean, that's whether these words that he are using, that he is using, are an implied do this thing or else, right? An implied you won't get your funding if you don't do this. Or, again, if I'm on the Democrat side, I'm definitely reading it that way. And if I'm on the pro-Trump side, I read that and I think, look, this is the way the guy talks all the time. Like, he could be talking to a four-year-old and he would be using this exact same kind of language. And it doesn't imply that he is trying to threaten the four-year-old, right? Because those are just Trumpisms. And again, it comes down to what you already think.
Well, so look, so what do you actually think?
What do I actually think?
What do you actually think?
I genuinely don't know, but I think that the evidence we have is tenuous at best. So, I mean, obviously Trump wants Ukraine to do this thing. I would be skeptical that he is clever or cunning enough to tie it to another function of what they're doing. That involves a knowledge of the bureaucracy that I'm just not convinced he has.
Well, but he literally withheld funding. I mean, he knows that there's funding, and he literally had this conversation.
Well, someone did.
And then they withheld the funding.
Well, he withheld the funding and then had the conversation, right? The funding.
Yeah.
I also don't know enough about the background. Like, I don't know, is this the sort of thing that presidents regularly do? Like, if we had, you know, if we were talking about Obama 5 years ago and the millions of dollars of aid to Iran and the Iran agreement, right? Would it, and if we had been listening in on a conversation between Obama and whoever the head of Iran is,
sure,
would it have sounded similar? You know, we want you to do this favor for us. We want you
to help in discrediting a political opponent.
Well, we
if
want
he had
you
done
to
that, it would have been wrong.
Again, we want you to you know, sign this agreement with us. We think it'd be good for our country. You're going to be wrapped up in much more dignified language because, of course, that's Obama versus Trump. So, again, I don't know if those kinds of negotiations are common to begin with, and then this is a bad use of them, in which case that's one issue.
It's not just about dignified language or undignified language. It's explicitly about soliciting assistance from a foreign government for political reasons. That's illegal. That is, like, straight up illegal.
Right. And that is, again, that is the Democratic line. And again, the Republican line is, no, that's not what they
do. That's literally the law. The law literally says you cannot solicit assistance.
No, but you're saying he did that. I'm saying, based on the transcript, I would want to know more about what these sorts of conversations normally sound like, both from Trump and from previous presidents, because it's not like he says explicitly.
Yeah, if Obama went to the Iranians and said, hey, I want your help investigating John McCain.
Oh, the Republicans would have had him executed. I mean, there's no doubt.
But
right?
is there any reason to think that
But the Democrats would have been like, this is fine. This is normal conversation.
Well, so look, again,
this
but,
is exactly
but,
what we want.
Maybe they would have.
They absolutely would have. You
maybe
know
they
would have.
But
in other words, we would have seen exactly what we're seeing now.
This is the sense in which you're being a sophist. It's like you're trying to withhold having to make a principled normative judgment on this by just saying, well, this always happens.
Yeah, based on my lack of knowledge about the specific details, yes. I'm perfectly willing to withhold my judgment on this.
You just said you read the transcript.
So I read the transcript of this one conversation. Again, I don't know how these sorts of conversations normally go, and I don't know how they normally go within the Trump administration and how they normally go.
You don't
go.
Need to know how they normally go. You just need to know whether it meets the standard. Is he soliciting assistance from a foreign government?
But then
he literally stood on the White House lawn and did it in front of everybody
right,
again.
So
that's the sense in which he's flouting like these democratic norms in such a way is that like you just get to a breaking point.
Yeah, and again, if it wasn't a breaking point when he did it against Hillary Clinton, then it's not a breaking point now.
And then I would have said, you're right, that was impeachable. Impeachment is a particularly dramatic, upsetting thing to happen. There is a point at which you have to draw the line. And now I think the wild flouting of these norms. And again, that's a difference because before he was denying that the conversations even took place. And now he's saying, oh, the conversations took place and they were beautiful conversations. And he's flouting the norms on the White House lawn. That's different than what happened before. So again, there are clear differences between what happened before and what happened now that is causing people, Democrats, who were previously against impeachment to now feel like they have no option.
Yeah. Again, I remain skeptical. I don't know. I don't, because I guess maybe it's just because I am not a fan of Trump, but by virtue of being on the right and not a fan of Trump, I kind of suspect everyone's motivations. So.
But look, I mean, so that's right. But at the end of the day, you got to make a judgment or you got to do something. People's motivations will be complicated.
Yeah, I mean, I am certainly comfortable.
It's like you want to have your cake and eat it too and be like, well, I don't like Trump. But
I'm certainly comfortable making the judgment that I'm very comfortable making the judgment that the Democrats are not doing this out of altruism. They're doing it because it's a political opportunity and they're taking it. I am very comfortable with that judgment. And I'm comfortable with that because they've had 4 years
I just made an argument that that can't be true.
Say that again?
And you didn't reply to that at all. I just made an argument that that can't be true.
I did address
that argument at all. The argument was before the Ukraine thing, they were dead set against it, or at least Nancy Pelosi was. And now she's switched. And it's almost certainly
the argument is because of this soliciting of. So the argument is because they're soliciting, he's soliciting a foreign nation. He has done that before. The previous occasions when he did that.
Yeah, but I made an argument about that again, not in this way, before he
denied. He has done it publicly during
happened,
a debate.
And now he's admitting that the conversations happened. It's such a grotesque flouting of democratic
right,
norms.
Right, and I argue it is no more grotesque than most of his flouting of democratic norms prior to this point. It's the timing that's different.
But the difference is before he denied the conversations, now he's admitting them. And before, Nancy Pelosi was like, no, we can't do this at all. And now she's like, well, we have to do this.
Yeah, and again, I think what you might mean is the tying of the request for help from Ukraine to aid. Because it's not just requesting aid from foreign powers, because he has done that publicly repeatedly before, both while he was candidate Trump and then in office. So that's not... Again, it can't just be that. Otherwise, I'm right.
No, I know, but the difference was he denied that he was doing
that. He did it publicly, Ed. He did it in speeches and at a debate. Like, so maybe he denied it, but, I mean, I watched it happen. So, again, either that was not impeachable, in which case it's not impeachable, or it has to do with the aid.
Well, so, again, I would say that it was impeachable. I expect Pelosi thought that it was impeachable.
Right. So what is different now? If it was impeachable then, or not, if it was impeachable and they didn't impeach, what's the difference now other than the
timing?
Because
now he's flouting it in a much more dramatic fashion.
How is it more dramatic?
Because again, before he denied that the conversations happened, and now he's admitting that the conversations happened.
Even though the conversation took place on national television.
The timing argument isn't particularly persuasive because you were like, well, why now? And literally we're talking about like she changed her mind from a month ago. And so it's not as if the political winds of fortune have changed so dramatically that if we waited a month, nah, now is the opportune time to unleash them. She does not want to impeach. No sane person.
And she may not. I agree with that. She may not impeach. I'm not even disagreeing with that. It may be that they just wrap things up in investigations for 9 months. This may be the.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, that might be her preferred way of dealing with this because she really doesn't want to impeach.
Sure.
But I suspect that at the end of the day, they're going to have a vote.
Right.
And I suspect that they're going to vote to impeach, and then we know what's going to happen in the Senate.
And I suspect that whatever had happened in the last month, whether it was a phone call to Ukraine or something else, because there's going to be something because that's been the characteristic of the Trump presidency. This was going to happen. The move was going to be made towards this. And again, that's because
well, not before the Ukraine thing.
Hey, it would have been something else. Anything. Fill in X scandal, because there's another scandal every month. So it would have been something. And then we would be hearing from the left, or hearing at least from Trump opponents, including people like David French, right? This is the thing, right? This is the thing that's the bridge too far, even though it's exactly like all of the other things that have come before this. Even though it's not really substantively different than anything else. This is the thing.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, like, sometimes eventually things are additive. Like, literally, you get to a point when you put the last straw on, it will literally break the camel's back.
Yeah, and again, then we're back to, well, it's mighty convenient timing.
But it isn't. That's the thing. That's false. What you just said is false. It isn't convenient timing.
Yeah.
Because if it was convenient timing, then it was all equally convenient timing in August. But she was like, no, we're not going to do this. Much to the chagrin of people on her left.
Yeah, and again, that's where I want to think more about it.
That's not an argument.
No, I'm comfortable with that argument.
That's not an argument.
I want to think more about this. I stand on that argument.
That's literally not an argument. You're just saying, well, I got to think about it. So that's fine.
Yeah.
So you can say, I got to think about it, but then you have to say, I currently have no good argument for this view. I'm going to think about it so I can think up something. But that just shows you're not really interested in figuring out what the truth is. You're just trying to defend a view.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to defend my view of saying a lot of the nuts and bolts of this, of the substantive issue in question, I have further questions about. Of the motivations of the people behind impeachment, I would want to think a little bit more about the possibility there, because I don't buy the altruism. And that, as far as that goes, yeah, I'm
well, nobody said anything about altruism, but there's a point at which you eventually get to a principled line. Yeah.
And this is the line. Like, that was the point.
It's not altruism. Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Because he was literally saying, yeah, I did it, and I don't care.
Yeah, and he's been saying that for 4 years.
And that's different than what happened. That is not true.
Hmm. Well, I don't know that we're going to get much beyond this, so we should probably get into the topic. I don't know how you're going to I don't know how as the host you're going to bring this back to
yeah,
Niebuhr.
No, so we're just going to switch gears. And,
yeah.
We'll put in the notes that there's a substantive conversation about impeachment, after which we follow with little segue into our conversation of Christ and culture, in which we move to the last two of Niebuhr's typologies, Christ and culture in paradox. And then Christ as the transformer of culture. And then I should say that we'll wrap up this conversation of these types, and then we'll come back next week and kind of do an all things considered conversation of what Coyle and I think about the book.
Was that another NPR reference?
It wasn't meant to be.
Okay.
Though that is a really good name for a new show. But in any case, Coyle, why don't you kick us off on the Christ and culture and paradox view?
So the Christ and culture and paradox is lumped by Niebuhr in with the Christ above culture crowd. So they're both seeking to preserve the both and of Scripture. So the emphasis is on the conflict. Their emphasis, the paradox people who he calls dualists. their focus is on the conflict between God and man, with culture being grouped in on the man side of things. So for the dualists, the starting point then has to be the cross, which comes to man through grace alone. Even conversion, he argues, and this is actually sort of a distraction, I think, in Niebuhr, but he says even conversion doesn't lead to inherent merit in the soul. So all worldly divisions are equalized in their rebellion against God, and all of our noblest efforts are touched with sin. Which is not to say there's no distinctions, right? There are different kinds of sins. Some sins are worse than others. There are worldly virtues. It's just that those distinctions pale in the comparison between the holy God and rebellious mankind. So each of our noblest efforts here is always ultimately just a lusting after power, however much we might dress it up in language of wisdom and courage and justice and so on. So we at the end of the day, we have to speak in paradoxes because we live in and we're part of this rebellious culture. And this makes sense given the ultimate paradox of the law and grace that can only be reconciled through the mystery of the cross. So that's his sort of short overview before he gets into the representative thinkers. Anything you'd add to that before we get to the thinkers?
No.
So the approach that he's taking here is he says it's more of an attitude than anything. It's not exactly a doctrine or a systematic theology, and that's going to be true of the next one also. They're both dispositions, for lack of a better word. He uses the word a motif. Paul is his scriptural type, even if he ultimately doesn't get lumped in with the dualists. It's his writings that shape these thinkers. The law governs our lives in the world, reveals wrath and sin, and points the way to salvation, but doesn't provide the power to get there. By contrast, or in paradox, salvation leads to freedom and new life, with the understanding that new life does not mean a new nation. So it's not like you are you were a Roman citizen and then you were converted and now you're the citizen of this new nation in this world. You're still a Roman citizen, maybe with an exception for the church, right? That's going to be the closest thing to a new nation that we've got. This new life provides hints, glimpses at the underlying divine reality of the universe. So marriage laws, political structures, economic systems, morality, all of these things bear the marks of the creator of the universe, but they are not there to provide a way to align mankind with the creator. They're there to reveal truth about God. They're there to show how fallen we are. They're there to restrain sin, but nothing beyond those things. Something like ethics, at the end of the day, either is going to be holiness lived within the individual Christian life, maybe within the corporate life of the church, or it's going to be just another aspect of full-on rebellion against God. Kind of within that side of things, at best, it's going to be temporary maintenance in a collapsing world. So that's Niebuhr's gloss of Paul. He also uses Martian as an example, the early church heretic, although Niebuhr says he's not a real dualist, which raises the question of why he mentions him, because one of the biggest points he makes is that he doesn't actually count. He's more of a Christ against culture thinker. He also mentions Augustine, the Scotists, the Occamists, and John Wycliffe. We'll get back to Augustine in the next section. Mm-hmm. Although in the next section he actually says Augustine is a dualist. So again, I think he's sort of reaching for examples with some of these. But the big name is Martin Luther. Certainly in his life and writings, he shows a dualism. So just practically, there's a treatise on Christian liberty, meaning a life of love, and then another treatise on killing murderous peasants. His thought at times, Niebuhr says, comes very, very near to compartmentalism, although what Luther really wants to do is just maintain an undivided distinction between the kingdoms, in the same way that God has distinct characteristics while remaining one unified being. So Luther argues God makes perfect demands on us, not just on our actions, but also on our motivations. He then saves and reforms the motivations when he redeems us, when he converts us, and sets us free to among other things, live in a fallen culture. So being a Christian in culture is living in these mysterious tensions of providence, where a world that was created good but is now fallen pulls us in one direction, which is inherently a sinful one, even though at times it looks like it's moving the right direction. And then on the other hand, a community of believers who were rebellious sinners but now have been redeemed pulls us in another direction, which is supposed to be a good one, but certainly at times goes the wrong direction as well. There's no idea that the church is always right. Ultimately, being a Christian and embracing this Christian culture and paradox gives us the ability to put these tensions into their proper perspective, to understand, this is what's happening, and I need to be sure that I'm aligning my internal desires correctly, that I'm placing them on Christ, on heaven, on what's going on in the church, and not on the institutions and structures and cultures of this world. Anything on Luther? He has some other guys that I can mention briefly, but anything you want to add in there?
No.
So he mentions Kierkegaard as someone who internalizes this dualism. I wrote in my notes here, Kierkegaard is also terrible, but that's a conversation for another day. And I don't know how to pronounce this gentleman's name.
Troeltsch.
Far too many consonants in a row there. He deals with the ethics and the historicity of the paradox. I know nothing whatsoever about him beyond what I've read in Niebuhr. And then Roger Williams is another example, who kicks off our American version of dualism with the wall of separation approach. And at the end of the day, the dualist position reflects, Niebuhr thinks, its strength is it reflects the dual nature of reality, the day-to-day struggles of real life, and it reflects the dynamic nature of God, grace, faith, and the redeemed life. But as is often the case, he includes weaknesses of the position. It can be abused either by retreating into cultural conservatism. I put in my notes here at some point as if that's an actual criticism, or by leading to antinomianism. But above all, Niebuhr thinks its main weakness is that it leads to the idea that cultural works are always passing away, which is where the dualist and the next group are going to separate out. And I don't want to steal anything from that, but the big criticism is that it might downplay the passing things of the world. That's Christ and culture and paradox. Anything to add there? Anything?
I can't help but take the bait on Kierkegaard.
Sure.
So what's your deal with Kierkegaard?
aside from the fact that he was just an awful, awful human being personally,
You mean the fact that he ended his engagement to Regina Olsen
in an especially brutal way. I mean, he didn't like beat her up or anything, but he was not the sort of person you would want to be friends with, if I am understanding the couple of biographies I've read correctly. And I should qualify this with I have read more books about Kierkegaard than I have by Kierkegaard, so it may be that I need to go and pick up more of his original writings to develop some sympathy. But he strikes me as being in the same vein as the emerging church folks in the 90s, sort of the I've discovered the truth now, everything else that's going on is wrong, and what we really need to do is just get back to sort of basic me and Jesus principles, and we'll set everything else aside and focus entirely on this internal relationship. Let's do away with systematic theology. Hegel was his special target at the time. Let's do away with structures and institutions and the church as a corporate body, and focus primarily on the personal existential relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just 100% wrong and leads where the emerging church goes in the early 2000s. But again, that's getting us off from off from his dualism, I don't know as much about his cultural critique, so I can't. It might be fine. I can't speak to that.
I think the important thing to appreciate about Kierkegaard's cultural and historical context is that he's operating in Denmark in the 19th century, which had this official Protestant church.
Sure.
And was engaged in a vociferous critique of the emptiness of their faith, the fact that it was just a kind of a cultural heritage associated with bourgeois values, and people didn't understand that to be a Christian was to be a follower of the living God as revealed through Jesus Christ.
And there is a place for that critique. I am, you know, as a Baptist, I'm clearly no fan of an established church. But there is also a way to take that critique too far. And I would say the same thing of Roger Williams. He kind of ends in the same place. But again, that's getting us away from the Christ and culture as paradox.
I don't disagree with that. Kierkegaard was very, very influential in me in a particular kind of a way when I first became a Christian. And I don't disagree with, but I think it's important to appreciate the context.
Yeah, I won't say there isn't a place for the criticism of cold dead theology. I think that there is a place for that, just as the emerging church in the 90s had a legitimate argument against what was going on in kind of mainstream evangelicalism. Like they were pointing out legitimate problems that needed to be responded to. But again, that's perhaps more of a side note than we need. Ed, tell us about Christ as the transformer of culture.
Yeah, so Niebuhr describes this as the convergenist attitude, and it is similar to dualism in a way, insofar as they both, quote, hold fast to the radical distinction between God's work in Christ and man's work in culture. But rather, unlike the dualist, Niebuhr writes that the conversionist does not take the road of exclusive Christianity into isolation from civilization or reject its institutions with Tolstoyan bitterness, right? And so there's the reference to Tolstoy, who we discussed back in our Christ against culture discussion, right? So they hold fast to this idea that there is a radical work between God's work in Christ and man's work in culture. But that radical distinction is one that gets bridged by the fact that while the world is fallen and radically broken, Christ is rescuing, transforming, and redeeming it. Christ is reconciling all things to himself. So the two worlds of the dualist perspective aren't separate, but get brought together in the incarnation and through Christ's work on the cross. So they're distinguished from dualists in this way, in their more positive or hopeful attitude towards culture, right? So it is a view that recognizes these two dimensions of reality, but see them as being ultimately bridged in Jesus, right? Jesus is redeeming all things. It's a stance that's rooted in seeing sin as sickness. The scripture talks about sin in a variety of different ways. One way is in terms of missing the mark, right? So like there is the mark of holiness and we just miss it. But equally it talks about sin as brokenness or sickness. And so maybe the transformer of culture is particularly hewing to that. To that kind of a view, like sin is brokenness, but God is healing his broken creation. Christ is redeeming all things. He's reconciling all things back to himself. And so Niebuhr notes that the conversionist mentality is particularly rooted in three theological convictions. The first of these, and I think the most important of these, is that conversionists are committed to a really robust view of creation. They start with creation and the recognition that God created everything that exists, and it is good. It is ultimately, initially, originally good, even very good, right? And so Niebuhr writes, "For the conversionist, the creative activity of God and of Christ in God is a major theme, neither overpowered by nor overpowering the idea of atonement." So there again, you get the recognition of this dualism, but this desire to sort of hold both of those things together. And then going on, Niebuhr writes, "He finds room," that is the conversionist, "finds room for affirmative and ordered response on the part of created man to the creative ordering work of God." So again, there's this like this there's this robust view of creation. God created everything good. And then the fall happened, and it got broken and corrupted. But the significance of Jesus, Niebuhr wants to link this to a deeper kind of Christology, where Jesus isn't just the one who died and was resurrected and returned to power, but he is all of that. And then also the eternal Word through whom all things were made, right? So Jesus was there at the beginning. It is through the Word of God that creation was enacted. And then it is through the incarnation, the crucifixion, and then the resurrection, that act of atonement, is what redeems the creation. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And so Christ is redeeming the creation. So there's that big, robust kind of creational theology that lies at the heart of the convergentist's mindset. And then equally, two more things. Second, the convergentist holds that we have to understand humanity's fall as a fall away from our created goodness. So again, there's that creational aspect. It's not that, as you maybe sometimes find in some dualist thought, that maybe starts to suggest that the creation itself was a kind of a fall. There's no, the creation was good. It's a fall away from that, right? So it's resisting that kind of Gnosticism that wants to see the very act of creation as being a bad thing. We were made good, and our fall has led to our corruption. Sin is a warping or twisting or misdirection of the good creation. It's a perverted good, but it isn't evil in and of itself. And so therefore, as Niebuhr writes, the problem of culture is a problem of its conversion, right? Creation needs to be converted, and it's not a question of replacement by new creation. Obviously, new creation is a radical kind of a rebirth. But it's a rebirth, not a replacement. It's a redemption, not an elimination and creating something wholly different. And then third, related to all of this, there is this view of history as a dramatic interaction between God and humanity, right? God meets his broken creation, and in that meeting, transforms things. So the emphasis is on our present encounter with God in Christ, and a little bit less about the final transformation of all things. Obviously, there will be a final transformation of all things, but the emphasis is more on the power of God to transform all things by lifting them up to himself. So he notes that, like, the metaphor isn't temporal, it's more spatial. The emphasis isn't what happens at the end, but it's what happens whenever God meets us and he lifts us up. So that's what the conversionist stance is. Then I'll dip into examples of the motif, but do you have questions or concerns about that discussion of what the view is?
No, I think it's
my characterization of it.
No. You've caught Niebuhr. I think Niebuhr probably does a disservice to conversionists here, but especially given the conversionists he chooses to pick on, use as examples. But we can come back to that if you want.
Yeah, and in what sense a disservice?
Oh, so the view of sin of a conversionist is not necessarily watered down. It doesn't have to be that sin is a weakness, right? It can be that sin is actual evil. Especially, I mean, his examples are Augustine and Calvin, and you would never read them and say, well, sin is just a sickness that needs to be cured. It might also mm-hmm. be that, but it is an active rebellion against God. It's just not a, you don't need to necessarily say that. Now, it may be what Niebuhr believes, but it's not necessarily what you're going to find in the pages of the Institutes or the City of God.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the sense in which, so Augustine is a particularly hard case. And certainly there are elements of Augustine that would tempt you to read him not as a conversionist, but as a dualist. And those are precisely the elements that want to draw our fallenness, to draw such a hard distinction. And so the characteristic thing about the conversionist mindset is, yeah, broken, fallen, radical disobedience, that's okay. But it's a radical disobedience that is a fall away from a good created state. And then the emphasis on, like, but God reaches out to us, and when we meet God, especially in the person of Jesus Christ, that transforms us, it restores us. It's not radical difference.
Which the dualists agree with all of that. Created good, fallen away, God reaches. I mean, that's not really the point of distinction, right? If it is, it's only between individual dualists and individual conversionists. It's not actually if we're going to have an overarching scheme, it's not a necessary point of distinction.
I guess that's right. And maybe that's part of the reason why he's like, look, these are subtle things. It's a little bit of an attitude. And certainly, like, a good way of capturing that attitude is sort of pessimism versus optimism. And, and then when you get down to the nitty-gritty, it can sort of be hard. It can be hard to find, like, a very specific kind of intellectual disagreement in which, like, ah, there you are. There's the line. But, like, I certainly have colleagues here who are, who I would describe as being dualist. And, in conversations with them, it becomes difficult to sort of pin down exactly what the intellectual difference might be. And there I give away my sympathies a little bit, I guess. But, like, you know, characterizing it as a kind of an attitude, I think, is a helpful way of getting it. It's just a kind of a... And the thing about creation, that's really important as well. But, like, you know, I mean, I do think that, yeah, so you're right. Certainly you can have... The conversionist certainly can think, often does think, about radical disobedience from God. Like, that's fine. But it's a little bit like, what? Is that a fall away? That's one thing. Is the emphasis on God meeting us and transforming us? And then third thing, the thing to which we are transformed, is that characterized as recreation? Or restoration, or reconciliation, or is that characterized as like a radically new, different kind of a thing?
Oh, and
I think where you fall on those little different issues, I think, is kind of the difference between tipping into dualism or tipping into conversionism.
Oh, and see, I think I would disagree, and I would say that on most of those issues, you could be either a dualist or a conversionist. But we should finish the chapter.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so that's 100% true. And so, like...
I think there's a core issue that does separate them out. And just... But we should get to
Okay, good. We'll get to that in a second. So, relatively quickly, in terms of the examples of the motif, he spends a lot of time at the end talking about the English theologian F.D. Morris. I'm going to spend less time about that because I expect... I mean, do you know his work?
I had never heard of him before reading this book.
Yeah. I'm the same way. I'm assuming that he was probably... If you're a theologian in the mid-20th century, Morris's work is really, really important. It's not the mid-20th century and I'm not a theologian. And I expect that interest in his work is going to be a little bit more boutique interest for specialists. To me, the more interesting example... So his biblical example... You know, Paul is the dualist. John is the conversionist. And he notes that certainly in John's gospel, you find a kind of a dualism, but it's never a dualism that suggests that the physical or material is subject to a special wrath of God. And so Niebuhr writes that the physical is never regarded as participating in evil in any particular way because they are not spiritual and eternal. So Niebuhr notes that in John, the world is used in both positive and negative ways, right? So, you know, the world as in worldliness and the rejection of God and all of that. But equally, the world as in John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he loved the world, that he sent his only begotten son, Jesus, right? I mean, the most famous verse in all of the Christian scriptures, probably, to the, at least to the 21st century American evangelical. Especially who's a sports fan, is like a good way of summarizing that. Certainly, John talks about the world in really wholly negative ways, as in worldliness. But at the same time, like, there's this recognition that the world, God loved the world, God created the world is good. Now the world has fallen, but God is restoring the world through Jesus Christ. You also think about the Colossians verse about Jesus reconciling all things back to himself. Jesus created everything, and now he's reconciling all things in heaven and on earth back to himself. But that's Pauline language. We should be talking about John. Well, I'm actually done talking about John. He also talks about Augustine. You know, and Augustine is a tricky figure. Certainly there are moments in Augustine's work. I'm actually teaching Confessions right now. But there are moments in Augustine's work that sound very dualist, but at the same time, Niebuhr notes that for many early Christians, there was this kind of this tradition that saw the regeneration of human society but through the replacement of pagan ideas with Trinitarian ones. That is a prominent theme in early Christian thought, and he counts Augustine as being a part of that. In fact, like the culmination of that in the City of God. Again, not that this is a pure theme in Augustine. There are certainly very dualist moments in Augustine. But he does think that in Augustine, you do get this kind of fundamental theory of creation, fall, and regeneration. And especially like his own story, his own conversion story, as being pagan and then a Christian. We had Chuck Matthews, who is a scholar of Augustine at the University of Virginia and an old friend. Chuck was making a nice point that's pretty obvious in some ways, that one of the reasons why Augustine is particularly interesting is that he's a convert. And among the early church fathers, you so rarely get the perspective of the convert. And that perspective is so interesting and illuminating in its own right. But you know, but even in Augustine's biography, you get this picture of like fallenness and redemption. Calvin as well. Calvin, you get a really robust view of creation. The fact that God is moving in creation, is redeeming creation. Certainly in neo-Calvinists of the Dutch variety, you get a development of that in kind of like the very richly creational thought of Kuyperians and other neo-Calvinists that see all of life as being under the lordship of Christ. And then Wesley, importantly as well, with his views about perfectionism and the fact that we, fallen as we are, in an encounter with Jesus, or can nevertheless be regenerated to something like a perfect life. That's a very convergentist kind of a thing to say. Thoughts about that stuff? That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, controversial stuff. I think he's probably right about Calvin. He mentions Edwards at one point as well. Wesley, certainly. I can't comment on Maurice, F.D. Maurice. I will point out that as for Augustine, he does point out that he's a complicated thinker. But then he points out that Augustine draws back from having a totally this world view of conversionism, and that for Augustine, the society that we're being converted into is an eschatological one, which to me sounds like he's a dualist. I mean, if the society you're moving towards is one that will not be accomplished this side of the eschaton, that, again, I why not just put him in the dualist category? I'd have to go back. It's been a couple of weeks since I've read this at this point, but while I was reading through, I seem to remember most of his, here's the evidence that Augustine is a dualist comments were drawn from City of God, and most of his, here's where Augustine is a conversionist comments are drawn from the sermons, which of course are targeted very differently. Right, you're talking to a discrete group of people there, as opposed to writing a general philosophical treatise. We don't need to get too hung up on any one of these guys.
But the sermons count, right? I mean, it's true that like it's a complicated case. I would also say that like no one. Certainly, people think this, but you don't have to think. Obviously, like nothing gets consummated finally until the eschaton. Like no one.
Sure.
That.
Sure.
Wesley's such a good example in some ways, because you really do that kind of get that perfectionism. I mean, he thinks that it's possible that people in this life, in an encounter with Jesus Christ, can become perfected or something like perfected. And you also get that social activism in Wesley that's such an important thing. But like, you know, no one thinks that it doesn't finally get redeemed. And it's a mistake to think that conversionism is that the conversionist has to think that it's things are slowly, steadily getting better all the time, and that there's radical continuity between now and what happens later. Like, you don't have to think that. Certainly, maybe there are some conversionists who think that, but you don't have to think that.
Well, it certainly on the big level, right? Big picture stuff, you have to think that if you're a conversionist. So if you're looking at, you know, 1,000 years of history, then you should see some improvement and some growth and some spread of the gospel. And there may be breaks across it.
I don't know about that, though.
If you're looking at 10 years of history, you might see, here's a thing where everything gets reset, or all of the Christians are wiped out and, you know, the communists win or whatever. But if you're looking at the grand sweep of history, I mean, if you're a conversionist, don't you have to see some kind of improvement over the course of history?
I don't think so. Okay. I think the emphasis is on the goodness of creation and the fact that God can redeem, that God is restoring the creation, not throwing it away and starting over, and that in an encounter with Jesus Christ, we can be transformed. But just because in principle we can be transformed doesn't mean that we will be transformed. And that even over the long haul, that things 1,000 years from now will necessarily be better than they are now. They might be worse. But it's the in principle idea that, like, he's not throwing it away and creating something else. He's redeeming what's good. It's a little bit of an attitude. But, like, I mean, you can be an optimist. Just because you're an optimist doesn't mean that you think that things are necessarily going to be better.
Well, again, not
in 10 years or 100 years or 1,000 years. But you just have to think that things can get better.
I mean, yeah, but then we're back into, that's not really a point of disagreement. That dualists think things can get better. Like, certainly historical conditions can improve.
Yeah, but then for the dualists, it's less about the restoration of the creation and more about the creation of something that is wholly new and different.
Sure. And I want to dig into
radical discontinuity.
Right. No, or at least a sort of discontinuity. Before we get into the dualist conversionist comparison, so the pattern in all of these chapters is, here's the introduction, examples, yeah. Walk through examples. Here's the reasons why this
problems.
Is solid. Walk us through Niebuhr's criticisms of conversionism.
So that's kind of the interesting thing. There are none.
Which I assume is just because it's such low-hanging fruit, he would have felt bad. Like, this is there's no reason to criticize this, because come on.
So that's kind of the interesting thing about the book. The book sets up these different types. It refers to them as being tools, maybe for various different times and places. And he's not necessarily recommending one above the others. But it is kind of true at the end of the day that he's a conversionist. It's about Christ transforming culture. You know, knowing anything about his other kinds of his social views and things like that, like, that's not a surprise. And yeah, and the book in some ways is kind of set up so that, like, you get around to the last chapter and you just kind of see that this is the best view. And that's also a pliable view, insofar as, like, even in some ways, if your attitude is more pessimistic, you can be like, but, you know,
Well, and I maintain what I said in an earlier episode, that the objections to the Christ of culture chapter necessarily are going to apply here. So even if he doesn't provide them here, he has provided them within the book. They're there to be read. Did you have anything else out of this? Otherwise, I want to go back to the comparison of the two.
Yeah. So, we'll talk about that point the next time. I mean, I would want to resist, actually, the point that you made. Insofar, in a certain kind of a way, accommodationism is always going to be a danger for everybody, right? But I think the special resource that the Christ transforming culture picture has, that the Christ of culture picture doesn't have, is that line between the world and us and our redeemed state. There's conversion. There's the cross of Jesus Christ, right?
We just have to get the fundamentally culture right.
Well, but Christ is redeeming it. Christ is rescuing it. He's reconciling all things on heaven and on earth back to himself, right? So you have to walk through the door that is Jesus Christ. You have to walk through the cross. And I would say that theologically, that's an important kind of a difference. Though in practice, the temptation for accommodation is always going to be there for us. You know, do not conform to the world.
And I think that's really the point of distinction between the dualists and the conversionists. So creation and fall, there can be points of difference there, but that's not necessarily always going to be the case. There's also, I think, when you're dealing with at least theologically orthodox believers and not bringing, you know, Martianites into the discussion for whatever reason, ultimately the point of distinction is going to be the question: what is actually redeemed on the cross? Is it just Christians, or is it Christians and whatever it is that the conversionists want to throw in? And
yeah,
that's the question.
Sure.
What is practically atoned for? If it is just people who repent and believe, then the dualists are right. And if it is people who repent and believe and institutions, cultural structures, music, nature, butterflies, whatever,
sure,
right, then the conversionists are right.
That's a really good way of putting the point, I think. I think that's exactly right.
So,
and I'm pretty sure I know the answer to that question.
There we go. I think the Bible
we'll
is very clear on the answer
time.
To that.
Oh, it's very, very, very clear. From Genesis to Revelation, that is absolutely 100% true. I somehow think that we're going to think that the answer to that question is different.
We will find out, if not next time, whenever these post.
Yeah, well, next time, unless the eschaton happens.
There we
go.
And
then we'll really know.
Right, this podcast could be totally sanctified, or it could be burnt. So
it could be.
There you go.
So, did you say your piece on everything that you wanted to say?
I think so. I think so. I mean,
great.
I could certainly say more about impeachment, but we probably shouldn't do that.
Well, that's a nice place to stop, I think. That's a really good way of characterizing the difference. And that's why I think that bit, Niebuhr's first point, that conversionists are committed to a robust view of creation, I think, like, that's the most important theme. you're either like deeply creational in that way, in that you think God created everything, he declared it good, and it's good, and so he ain't leaving it behind. He's going to redeem it. Or you think, nah, just souls, and then that's kind of it. And we're going to get swept away into some radically other existence. But the way that you put the point, I think is a really good way to put the point. And that's a nice kind of cliffhanger for our next episode. I think everybody knows what I think about these things. Though, in some ways, I think I am critical of the categories, but I do think that the way that you summarize the difference is a good way of doing it. Now, I want to ask you a question. I'm not going to spoil your all things considered view. But at the end of the day, do you want to do away with the categories? Or at the end of the day, do you like, are you like, no, this one more or less, like more or less, is the right view, and I'm this.
I don't want to do away with them because they are super convenient for teaching purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So, no.
But do you think they're ultimately confused?
No, I mean, clearly there are people who do fit into these categories, right? I mean, mm-hmm. there are people who wash their hands of everything and go form their own culture, and there are people who genuinely think that the atonement covers, you know, Congress. And there are people who genuinely believe that, you know, it doesn't. And there are people who, you know, I mean, we could go through each of these. There are people who fit into these.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not sure it's the most useful way to break it up, but it is a useful way to break it up.
Okay.
So it's,
and at the end of the day, do your sympathies lie with one or another?
I mean, I could pick one that I'm more sympathetic with. I'm going to prefer. So, well, you probably know this stuff better than I do. In the time since Niebuhr, sort of the language has evolved, and now we would talk about two kingdoms versus neo-Calvinism versus, you know, all of the Anabaptist tradition. I think those are much more useful categories.
Yeah.
And I think they're if only because we've had 70 years to work on them since this book came out. So mm-hmm. I think there's it's just more practical to say something like I'm in the Anabaptist tradition or I'm in the neo-Calvinist tradition than to say I'm a dualist. So it's not to say they weren't necessarily useful in, you know, the mid 50s, but since things have developed and been sharpened since then.
Yeah,
I think we have.
Yeah, I actually don't know a super ton about that new language and like the two kingdoms view. And so what I like about the Christ and culture, again, I mean, the categories are really handy.
Sure.
And they describe attitudes and you can think of people. But I particularly like them for exactly the way that you put the point, that at the end of the day, I think kind of the most, not the only issue and not the only important issue, but I think the most important issue is the creational issue. And that's why I particularly like the theory in that it puts its finger on, like, this is the issue, and you have to have an opinion about this. And I think that's exactly right. Okay. Well, you have wasted another perfectly good hour listening to, or 90 minutes, or whatever we're at now, listening to the City of Man podcast. We are happy to be members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. It would be awesome if you could leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and give us 5 stars and talk about how much you like us. If you want, you can reach out to us. We're trying to do a better job of replying to the Gmail account. So email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Or equally, maybe we are a little bit more spry in responding to Facebook interactions. And you can check us out at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. And on behalf of Coil and myself, let me remind everyone to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks a lot for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high...